The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Edmund Berger is the guest this week. Berger is an independent writer, researcher, and activist living in Louisville, Kentucky. He blogs intermittently at Deterritorial Investigations Unit and Synthetic Zero, two oddly named blogs. His first book, entitled Uncertain Future, provides a detailed look into the economic and political conditions of our present moment from a Marxist perspective. It's Wednesday, April 5th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Thanks should go out to members of the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to Inside Zero Books, which sometimes consists of unedited or full-length interviews from the Zero Squared podcast, sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left, and sometimes features public lectures from Zero Books authors or staff. This week, the Inside Zero Books podcast will feature the second half of this conversation with Edmund Berger on Marx and Trump. I should also take a moment to ask you to stop by the Zero Books website and purchase a book on critical theory. You might pick up Uncertain Futures or Alfie Bound's interview with Sreco Horvat. The music you're listening to is the vaporwave hit Morning Coffee. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Edmund Berger and I discuss our uncertain future. Edmund Berger is an independent writer, researcher, and activist living in Louisville, Kentucky. He is a blogger at both the Deterritorial Investigations Unit, which sounds like something out of a science fiction show, and and Synthetic Zero. His book, Uncertain Futures, An Assessment of the Conditions of the Present, was published last month by Zero Books, and it's doing well. Edmund Berger, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So let's start by just finding out a little bit about you. Tell me about Louisville. I think of Kentucky as a red state, but Louisville is the maybe like the Boulder. I'm from Colorado originally, so like the Boulder of Kentucky or the Austin, Texas of Kentucky.
Oh yeah, it's like it's really strange because it's Louisville and Kentucky. It's like you couldn't be more different, essentially. But I mean, I guess they both share a love of horse racing and drinking bourbon and stuff like that. But when it comes to the political content, yeah, just no comparison whatsoever. And I know that really actually shapes out quite weird in a lot of our elections, where Louisville goes Democrat, the rest of the state goes Republican. But I don't know, in a lot of the rural areas in the last election, the presidential election, actually, a lot of the counties went towards Bernie Sanders. And then when it became clear that Sanders wasn't going to get it, they switched over to Trump. So there's also that dynamic at play.
Wow. Yeah, that's a weird move. I mean, that's not. I kind of understand why some people would do that, but it seems mistaken to me.
It's definitely mistaken, but I think it's also kind of like, I don't know, there's an important insight there, I think.
Well, tell me what you think it is, because I mean, it's been discussed a lot, but I'd love to hear it from someone from Louisville.
Oh yeah, well, in regards to Kentucky or just in general?
No, just I'd actually like to hear why you think people could move from Bernie Sanders to Trump.
I actually think that that pretty much gets at the real heart of the matter there. When we had, in this last election, pretty much you had the insurgence of populism from the left, insurgence of populism from the right. And while the left might go certain directions on social programs, multicultural politics. When it comes to economics, there's really not too much of a difference there. It's very anti-free trade, anti-globalization, and at certain points, anti-deregulation.
Mm.
So somebody, you know, will be, like I talked to quite a few Sanders supporters who said that if they weren't going to go for Sanders, or if Sanders didn't get it, they would end up going for towards Trump because of the way he talked about, say, NAFTA and things of that nature.
So it's a really important issue for people in Louisville, people you knew who liked Bernie Sanders, that we break away from this the neoliberal politics that are embodied and summarized by, you know, NAFTA, GATT, and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Out to be a defining moment for our nation. I spoke with one of the folks who was in the reception just a few moments ago. He told me that he was in China watching the vote on international television when it was taken. And he said, you would have had to be there to understand how important this was to the rest of the world. Not because of the terms of NAFTA, which basically is a trade agreement between the United States, Mexico, and Canada, but because it became a symbolic struggle for the spirit of our country and for how we would approach this very difficult and rapidly changing world, dealing with our own considerable challenges here at home. I believe we have made a decision now that will permit us to create an economic order in the world that will promote more growth, more equality, better preservation of the environment, and a greater possibility of world peace. We are on the verge of a global economic expansion that is sparked by the fact that the United States at this critical moment.
It's been really difficult, the election of Trump, because it seems to me that the failure to have any substantial political movement around that can actually address the economic problems that we're facing leads to somebody like Trump coming around. And at the same time, if you take some of Marx's core concepts seriously, just like the labor theory of value and the tendency of greater profit to fall, and you decide that you really think that you need to, that there needs to be some sort of substantial break, revolutionary break with the capitalist form, it's very difficult to formulate or come up with a serious political movement or even some basic ideas to how to, you know, start something, because so much of what's exists on the far left that involves Marx, there's so much of that, and it kind of steals the oxygen from Marx's thought, and it's also so ineffectual and sort of strangely almost like these are like little religious cults that are running around in the name of Marx. So you don't want to get involved with that, really. And at the same time, the only other kinds of options that are ready to hand anyway are reformist. You know, you have the Sanders campaign, or maybe the DSA, or other kinds of reformist movements. So I feel after Trump that I am actually becoming more conservative in so much as that.
Really?
Yes, because I want these reformist movements to succeed, which before was more revolutionary, right? So, I mean, I'm not sure if that's truly more conservative, but I just don't see – I'm more willing to embrace somebody from the DSA or even Bernie Sanders than I was before – the election of Trump. And I wouldn't feel that way if Clinton had been elected, I don't think.
So. See, that's actually kind of funny because I feel like I kind of went the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Like I was still kind of wary of reformist movements, but stepping back and kind of looking at it, and I just feel like if we keep doing kind of like this double movement of, you know, swinging from like a right populist back to neoliberal and then the left populist, like you're not breaking out of that system. You're just kind of playing in the capitalist field itself, maybe just rearranging a few small variables that might have more capital, you know, flowing, trickling downwards to the working class and less going to finance or more going to manufacturing. But at the end of the day, aside from maybe being like a release valve or, you know, take a little pressure off the working class, I don't see reformists as doing much of anything except perpetuating that which they're allegedly against.
I mean, I, in theory, I agree with you, but it just seems that Trump, it just seems like if Sanders had won the primary, it would have been likely that Trump would have lost the general. And even if he hadn't, and even if he hadn't lost the general election, even if Trump had won against Sanders, I feel as though the left, such as it is, would be in a much stronger position.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that as well. I do agree with you there.
That's some sort of embrace of reformism.
You know, that is the classic kind of conundrum that those of the on the left like find us within. And I think the way that I would think about it, like, if I was in prison, I wouldn't refuse food, you know, like I'll take the food from the guards in order to survive. And I think that we just got to keep reformism kind of in that mentality, like this, you know, I'm not going to starve to death out here, but, you know, I'm going to try to be escaping from this prison at every turn.
Made it. Oh, you don't know what it means to escape. I thought I'd never see this day. How long? How long has it been that I dreamed of this day?
Oh, has it been?
Forever. A lifetime. How long is life imprisonment? It's an eternity. That's how long.
I'm sorry.
But it's all over now. I'll never see the inside of that place again.
This is the first campaign that I can recall where my party did not talk about what it always stood for, and that is how to maintain a burgeoning middle class. You didn't hear a single solitary sentence in the last campaign about that guy working on the assembly line making $60,000 a year and the wife making $32,000 as a hostess in a restaurant, and they making $90,000. They got two kids and they can't make it, and they're scared.
It's just taking serious problems in our society and trying to soothe them a little bit, fan them a little bit with the welfare and other grant disbursements, but it doesn't get at the root of the problem.
Let's talk about, in a little bit more technical way, about your book and about how you attempt to link the economic crisis of 2007 to this right-wing populist upsurge nearly a decade later now.
In the book, I deviate from Marx a bit, and that I look at Polanyi's argument of what he calls like the double movement or the self-protection of society. The thing is that Trump didn't just kind of rise out of thin air, and Sanders didn't rise out of thin air. There's a, you know, going back over that almost decade, there's grassroots movements and even elite factions, you know, movements in the government that all kind of coalesced. We're trying to push back against kind of this neoliberal system that was going off the rails. It wasn't working. It was malfunctioning. And so I think if we were to like make a genealogy, we could very clearly map out, say, from like Occupy to Sanders, or even like certain elements of the Tea Party and stuff before that up through Trump. So I think that in historical hindsight, like, this moment seems kind of obvious. Like, we shouldn't have been as caught off guard as we were, because it was there and it was growing.
Because when I look at Sanders particularly, it's hard for me to make a direct connection between his campaign and the kind of actual organizing that went around Occupy. Because my feeling about Occupy, or my understanding of what happened with the Occupy Wall Street movement, is that it had its moment. There were lots of activity, was organized. And then those organizers went off in a bunch of different directions, and that there wasn't a party, say, or even an attempt to infiltrate the Democratic Party that was actually well organized out of Occupy. If anything, it was just a sentiment that maybe persisted. With the Tea Party, they did make more successful inroads into the Republican Party.
Yeah, like I think that was the real interesting thing about the Tea Party, is that if you really go back and you look at it, between, you know, there was this this incredible, like, the dark money machinery around the Kochs, Heritage Foundation, Freedom Works, all those different organizations. But then there was like this grassroots that they tried to tap into, and quite often, like, the rhetoric that was coming out, or rhetoric and ideas that was coming out of kind of the official machinery, it was pretty different from a lot of the stuff that was happening in the Tea Party base. The official Tea Party movement was really just Reaganite neoliberalism in terms of, like, deregulatory policies, privatized Social Security, repeal Obamacare, you know, climate change denial, stuff like that. But in the base, you started to see like very strong anti-immigration rhetoric bubbling up, anti-free trade deals. Like I remember when I was in Occupy, there was like kind of this interesting collision between like occupiers and Tea Partiers. Like, yeah, NAFTA's problematic, and that's kind of a weird thing to see, you know. And it didn't really match what was coming out of, say, Freedom Works or the Heritage Foundation. So I think that, you know, we really see this springing up of right populism there. That's kind of the way that the Democrats became detached from what was going on in their own party base. The Republicans, who were trying to ride that Tea Party wave into this election last year, and they just completely lost sight of what was going on the ground. Because this was supposed to be the Tea Party election. This is what they were gearing towards. If you like go back and like read through their documents, or just kind of like follow the way that the money was flowing to these different candidates, populism really just kind of rose up and flipped the card over.
I'm old enough to remember the passage of NAFTA. You know, I was an adult when that happened, and sadly. And the left was charged with xenophobia at that time. There was a populist side, or there was a right populist side to the anti-NAFTA protesters even then. And there was a strange alliance between the right and left around NAFTA, really from the start.
And what's interesting about that is I think that people who kind of, I guess they were known before that, but became well-known again, maybe people like Pat Buchanan, who kind of, he's definitely a right populist, but, you know, people around him made pretty vital alliances with the left, like in Seattle in 99. But then, you know, you fast forward to today and you have like Pat Buchanan endorsing Donald Trump, and, you know, also like ties that had existed between the two of them going back to around 1999, 2000. So I think that there's a continuity between what you're describing and what's going on today. Definitely. Yeah.
The Ross Perot, his whole campaign.
Yeah. Oh, great example.
What will you do as president to open foreign markets to fair competition from American business and to stop unfair competition here at home from foreign countries so that we can bring jobs back to the United States?
That's right at the top of my agenda. We've shipped millions of jobs overseas, and we have a strange situation because we have a process in Washington where after you've served for a while, you cash in, become a foreign lobbyist, make $30,000 a month, then take a leave, work on presidential campaigns, make sure you got good contacts, and then go back out. Now, if you just want to get down to brass tacks, first thing you ought to do is get all these folks who've got these one-way trade agreements that we've negotiated over the years and say, fellas, we'll take the same deal we gave you. And they'll gridlock right at that point because, for example, we've got international competitors who simply could not unload their cars off the ships if they had to comply. You see, if it was a two-way street, just couldn't do it. We have got to stop sending jobs overseas. To those of you in the audience who are business people, pretty simple. If you're paying $12, $13, $14 an hour for factory workers, and you can move your factory south the border, pay a dollar an hour for labor, hire a young 25, that's assuming you've been in business for a long time, you've got a mature workforce. Pay a dollar an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south. So if the people send me to Washington, the first thing I'll do is study
years. Well, I've been a senator,
you haven't
Donald,
done it. You haven't
I have been a Secretary of State, and I have
your
done
your husband signed NAFTA, which was one of the worst things that ever happened
well,
to the manufacturing industry.
That is your opinion.
You go to New England, you go to Ohio, Pennsylvania, you go anywhere you want, Secretary Clinton, and you will see devastation where manufacturing
sometimes 50%. NAFTA is the worst trade deal maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country. And now you want to approve Trans-Pacific Partnership. You were totally in favor of it. Then you heard what I was saying, how bad it is, and you said, I can't win that debate. But you know that if you did win, you would approve that, and that would be almost as bad as NAFTA.
Well,
nothing will ever top NAFTA.
That is just not accurate. I was against it once it was finally negotiated.
Yeah, well, back in that time period, Donald Trump did very briefly try to get the presidential nomination on the Reform Party ticket, which was the party that was affiliated with Ross Perot at one point, and Buchanan, also Ron Paul.
So that was what? That was back in 2000?
I believe that was, 2000-ish, 2000, 2002.
Yeah. So there is definitely a continuity in the ideology that informs Trump. As strange as it is to say any ideology informs Trump, but that's been there, and it's always been a kind of strange combination of left and right thinking. I mean, my own father voted for Perot in 92.
I think that my dad was into him, but I'm not sure.
It makes me wonder if the emphasis on NAFTA and these trade deals are misplaced. I mean, especially if you take into account that pointing to NAFTA or international trade as the main cause of unemployment since 2007 seems entirely misguided to me. It just seems to me that the unemployment that we faced and the underemployment and the way people have been sort of dropped out of the whole system since the economic crisis has a lot more to do with the economic crisis and the troubles that industries have here in the United States and in profitable investment than it does with freeing up trade or mobility even of immigrants. I mean, it's certainly true that a lot of industrial work has moved overseas, but even that is not primarily caused by these trade agreements. There are other forces that are really pushing that for that to happen.
Yeah, I think that that's like a really good point. Like we talk about how America has lost its manufacturing base, and that's what it was the middle class or whatever was built on in the post-war era, and across the 70s and 80s and 90s, there was this flight of manufacturing capital to China and Southeast Asia and other places, Mexico. But if you really break it down, look at the numbers, that may be true, but industrial manufacturing output from the U.S. has been climbing at an exponential rate, employment constantly falling. Yeah, there's no question that the people who made that, they're living there, they're being gutted. But at the same time, it's more efficient in terms of just pumping out commodities than it's ever been. And that's because it's not so much the relocation to, you know, the global peripheries or the global south or however you want to describe it. It's just because machinery itself is, you know, you can do a lot more with one machine than you could with, say, five people in the past. And that brings you back to, like, some really important Marxian points about the organic composition of capital. That's kind of what we're seeing, is the replacement of human labor with machine labor, and capital flowing in that direction, kind of driving down the value that goes into every single commodity.
Automation has been a big part of the continued decline in industrial work in the United States. You point out something that I think I might have known at one point, but I forgot, which is that our industrial output has been increasing, not decreasing, over all those years.
It's just crazy if you look at, like, the charts. If you go to the St. Louis Fed website, you can pull that pretty quickly, and it's incredible to look at.
That brings us to all these other sort of seductive questions. Like, people are very fascinated with the idea of how great the AI is going to be when he fully arrives, right? Like, when everything is fully automated and all the robots have taken over, what will we do? There'll have to be universal basic income, you know, that kind of thing. To me, that shows a fundamental lack of understanding of how capitalism works when you say, oh yeah, when everyone's unemployed because of the robots, we'll tax those corporations whose profits will be declining, you know, so thoroughly that everyone will have a great, you know, living wage income just based off the government teat. It just doesn't make any sense within this system. But fighting automation was a much more difficult political problem. Well, first of all, there's no external enemy to blame. And secondly, no one has any plans.
Nobody has plans. And also it's such a difficult issue, because at the end of the day, like, who doesn't want to, you know, be liberated from labor? You know, like, I think the question is, like, what will people do is a really wrong way to be, like, looking at it.
Right. Have you ever read the book Player Piano by Kurt Vonnegut?
I have not, actually. I have a copy of it, but I have not read it.
Okay. Well, it's all about, you know, his whole premise is that in a society where everything's automated, people won't know what to do with themselves, and, you know, they'll lose some of their humanity and so on and so forth.
I think what's interesting, like, if you go to, like, I don't know, some of the weirder chapters in the third volume of Capital, like Marx does this really funny kind of twist where he's, you know, we're talking about all the time about, like, labor having, like, this revolutionary role, but in, like, I think it's chapter, like, 15, and he gets really weird, and he talks about how, like, machinery is, you know, the automation is rising, it's coming up, you know, the productive forces are being developed. It almost seems to indicate, like, communism, like, whatever that is really value plummeting to zero, the human being removed from the productive process, which is, like, a really weird thought. And because, you know, Marx writing at a time where there's not really a concept of automation, it's kind of wonky to read, but I don't know, I think it's an interesting thought experiment and kind of changes the way that, like, some of the rest of his stuff looks. And I don't think that we should try to halt automation. I think the left accelerationist line on it, the universal basic income, I think that that's really misguided and kind of incoherent. So you have to start asking, you know, how do you deal with that? And it means very radical structural changes in the way that we organize society and organize production.
Well, getting back into the politics, because they seem to matter. Because how do we start talking about these issues in a way that can be politicized?
You can talk about the esoteric elements of Marxist theory all day, but this is, like, the really hard issue is, you know, how to make them appear as relevant.
Yeah, it's not even a matter of, like, making them appear as relevant, but it's because the problem is, it's not that they're relevant, but people don't understand. The problem is they're probably relevant, but no one understands how they're relevant, you know? Like, because I don't know what to do with the information, basically. And if I don't know what to do with the information, you know, how is that going to help me formulate even my own politics, let alone organize other people?
heavy stuff.
Come on, solve it. Hurry.
I'm trying to think. Because coming from an activist like background, this is the question that everybody asks, and we're always asking it. You know, endless hours of horrible meetings talking about this, and it's just like nobody can really come up with a good concrete answer on how to do it. That's what's really interesting. And at this moment in time, like there's really no shortage of political movements. Like it's right now, like America and the rest of the world is not some barren landscape where nothing's happening. Like stuff is happening everywhere. And I think that that's what's really incredible. But at the same time, you know, we can't rely on spontaneous, you know, rising up to kind of coalesce into some revolutionary break. Obviously, that's what people back in the 90s thought was coming, and just it didn't work. And no reason to expect that it would again. But then on the flip side, it's like party building and coalition building, it just, that doesn't work either. The big broad, you know, there, nobody's going to be storming the Winter Palace in, you know, 2017. I don't think, at least, you know, I could be wrong.
Well, maybe the way to go about it is to think a little bit more, not on the activist side, but on the theoretical side, because you said something a moment ago that's interesting that I it's sort of sticking in my craw, which is that communism would involve removing maybe not all humans from productive work, but getting value down to zero. In other words, removing the creation of value as Marx thought of it, or, you know, the labor value.
Magnitudes of labor rolling in.
Yeah, removing that from our productive activity. That would be what it took. But that doesn't... That's not necessarily going to happen. It's a question as to whether that is going to happen as a crisis, you know, as when we're fully automated, that will happen. Or
yeah, like it'll just unshackle or something.
Right. Or like, you know, suddenly, like at the end of have you ever seen the movie Time Travel or Wanted at Your Own Risk or something? There's a movie at the end of that movie. They suddenly, it turns out what they thought was fake turns into a real time traveling device, and by some miracle, everything is saved. So that could be what happens with capitalist productions. Like at the end, it just, you know, the
one day everybody wakes up and the
factory,
you know, the final automated piece slides into place.
They say, "You're free, labor." Yeah, but that seems unlikely. I mean,
yeah, it seems very unlikely. You know, that would be pretty nice.
Yeah, I think it would make a poor movie, an unconvincing ending. But the other approach to it is that somehow or another we develop a way of producing the world and creating what we need on this, something like the scale of what we already have, but without creating that value.
Well, I think that that's it's an interesting proposition, and I think that that also, like, it points, I think, if I'm... like understand what you're saying correctly, points to something that's really different from our time and Marx's time. Whereas, like in Marx's time, he was envisioning these processes kind of taking place through like the commanding heights of the industrial economy. You know, it's big factories, mass manufacturing, big, you know, steam furnaces churning out, you know, stuff and conveyor belts. Well, I guess there weren't conveyor belts yet, but, you know, the classic imagery of the gigantic factory. In today's age, like, we still have gigantic factories, but that whole system is kind of untenable. And we're seeing like some really dynamic, like miniaturizations of production. Even things like 3D printers or other desktop manufacturing techniques, you know, allows you to create stuff on a much smaller scale than the big factory. But it also, you know, I could make something, conceivably make something, and distribute it in my community or just use it for myself. And that would drop me out of the capitalist system, I guess, in a way.
Right. Well, if you did, if you produced it for yourself and you didn't distribute it in the market and you were self-sufficient based on what you could print from your 3D printer, you would sort of be outside the capitalist system. Although I wonder about the parts that go into that 3D printer and the,
Yeah, there's the supply chains and the different departments. Yeah. But I think that maybe not the 3D printer might not be the best example of like what I'm trying to describe, but I just think that there is a much greater capacity for speeding up production, but also kind of narrowing the scope of it in our times more than in Marx's times. One could conceive of a truly like community-based technology today far more so than, you know, immediately after the Industrial Revolution.
Sure, and you could also we've just developed different kinds of technology, many, many different kinds of technology, and we have the internet and communication technology such that some of the engineering or technological challenges are less of a challenge today than they had been and would have been back in Marx's time. So surely we have the capacity to develop new modes of production at a faster pace and in a more interesting way, than people in Marx's time did. So if we think of it strictly as an engineering problem, it seems like it should be solvable, but it's not strictly an engineering problem.
Yeah, the political and social problem.
Right. But it's going to probably involve some of these engineering, you know, the tendency to try to design utopian ways of life, whether it's utopian factories or utopian villages or, yeah. I mean, there's a long tradition of that, and those are fun. But I still feel like there's something that we have to, the getting rid of value is going to be tricky. But let's talk a bit more about your actual book here and sell our product.